Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their travel trailer, which they have nicknamed Bessie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. I was feeling inspired after our jaunt to the National Western in Denver this year. A lot of things came together for us in a really positive way, and that strikes a chord with me. I'm the kind of person that likes to feel like there's a greater arrangement of material in the universe. Some people might call that a higher design, some might call it an evolutionary system, and some might just say that life happens and we think it's a pattern. But it makes me feel good to feel a part of it when the pieces fit together nicely, whatever you call it. We're talking with people about the North American bison this month. When I was thinking about what I wanted to say to introduce this month's podcasts, I had some thoughts formed with my usual homage to pop culture and sci-fi. Considering that greater pattern idea if you're a Fringe fan. Whether or not we understand how or why, the pattern exists and we're all a little piece in there somewhere that connects to another. My brain was full of philosophy and big picture ideas and the interconnectedness of the creatures on the prairie and, well, it made me feel rather lofty. And that died a quick death a few days ago when I stepped off a curb the wrong way and busted my foot. Literally busted, as in I'm sitting on the sofa with my foot elevated because there are a few little pieces of bone down there that used to be connected but now are not. Broken, damn it. I've been sitting here bored silly and in a cranky state for the last few days with all of my grandiose philosophical ideas crashing and burning with one little wrong step. That idiot moment on the curb has determined my productivity for what hopefully will be only the next few weeks, but I'm sure I'm going to be feeling it for months. But that got me thinking about what it must be like to be an animal whose survival depends on where their feet go and how sure they place them. It's a few frustrating days planted to the furniture for me, followed by some slow hobbles up and down the back steps at work for a month or two. But if you're an animal with mass, all centered on four little pieces of what amounts to fingernails? It's life or death. You break a foot out there, and the odds are very good that you're now toast, baby. The places they live, it can be really desolate. The bison are the symbol of the Great Plains, after all. There used to be over 30 million of them in North America before we nearly wiped them off the face of the earth, but if you want to see them now, you usually go to places like the grasslands of Wyoming, or Montana, or the Dakotas. Okay, let me stop this train of thought for a sec to admit something that's a bit embarrassing, and it's not something I'm proud of. Sometimes, try as I might, I demonstrate that horrible habit of making a judgment about something based on one or two experiences. And the Dakotas are one of those areas that the universe used to show me how ridiculously ignorant that habit of microjudging can be. For all of you who have never traveled up there, I'll talk about the geography for a minute. First of all, you have to really want to go if you're going to go. It's not like either North or South Dakota are on the way to anywhere in the main lines of traffic across the United States, unless you're a trucker and you're hauling freight from Wisconsin to Seattle. Or if you're picking up one of those new RVs from the factories near Minnesota and you're delivering it to Salt Lake City for the tourist season. Actually, you might miss the Dakotas even then, depending on your route, but needless to say, it's pretty far out of the beaten path for most of America. The Dakotas are pretty hot in the summer, and they're very cold in the winter, and you have to be pretty darn tough to make it there. I don't mean like Sturgis tough, no offense to all you bikers out there. It's survival tough. That particular stretch of geography seemed to me as if it's not so much like a casual bar fight as it is something out of Mad Max. If you're going all the way up to Theodore Roosevelt National Park North Unit, you can drive and drive, and you're not going to see much of anything more than those big oil trucks going back and forth periodically. Prairie dogs and hawks and lots of lonely, lonely mileage. And dust. Lots of dust. You better have water and a satellite phone if you're going to break down. My opinion of both North and South Dakota was built on the snippets I'd seen on TV and one drive north. And other than that little bit of don't go within 1,000 miles of the Dakotas during Sturgis Week, or don't go there in anything other than a very comfortable shoulder season, or don't go there unless you really have to get somewhere and that's the shortest route, well, that was pretty much my opinion of that very middle, very top half of the country. And yes, I am ignorant and judgmental and kind of stupid sometimes. Which was proven to me when we visited Custer State Park in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I had to consider that as one of the places on Earth that was beautiful and peaceful enough that I would consider having my earthly remains sprinkled there. If Rick were willing to get arrested for it anyway. Custer was an amazing spot, and it's not the only one in the Dakotas. Teddy Roosevelt National Park North and South units are ones that are well worth the visit as well. Not only is that landscape raw and beautiful, it also contains people like today's podcast guest, a guy named Chad Kramer. I met him when I shouldered my way into a crowd outside the bison exhibit at the National Western, where a group of people were in the middle of bison Q&A. I still don't entirely know what that was, but I think it has to do with some people who raise the animals for a living and want to know more, and also people like me, wanting to know more about why they chose an animal that seems to be a bit off the agricultural norm. But the guy that I cajoled out of that crowd and begged for a few moments of conversation just happened to be the president of the National Bison Association, the herd manager for Custer State Park in South Dakota, and he has his own ranch to boot. Can I pick more what? He was an incredibly gracious man, and he was very patient with both my cold-induced chattering and my inability to keep my eyes away from what was one of the most amazing mustaches I've ever seen. I'm sure he gets that a lot, but he was still very kind about it. If you go to his website, he actually has a blog called Thoughts from the Mustache, so it must not just be me. I hope you follow the links in our intro to learn more about all of the above, and not just the mustache. And if you'd like to see this mustache for yourself, well, we're kicking off a new series. It's called Vicarious Agriculture, and you can see an episode on our Backyard Green Films YouTube channel. The North American bison is truly one of the last wild wonders that we can get up close and personal with these days. It's not just the feisty wildness of them, it's also their size. They pack on anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 pounds of muscle and bone, all balanced on 4 points of hoof. The physics of balancing all that weight on 4 comparatively small points is pretty impressive. And top that off with the fact that it's a migratory animal. Well, that makes the ambulatory part all the more important. When you think of the sheer number of prairie dog holes on the grassland plains and the amount of time an animal like the North American bison must graze and run right across the top of them, the odds are that hooves and holes meet frequently. You commonly see them rolling around in their wallows when they're pictured, but it looks pretty planned to me and not the result of a bad step on the way to work. And I'd bet almost anything that none of them end up sitting on their butts on the sofa for days with their foot elevated. Kind of makes you wonder which one of us is higher in the evolutionary scale, does it not? It definitely shows which one of us is the sturdier beast. And yes, all of you North and South Dakotans, I'm sure my California heritage has something to do with it. Thanks again, Chad, for a delightful conversation, regardless of the weather. I'm actually very much looking forward to my return to your beautiful part of the world. Hi, would you introduce yourself, please?
So I'm Chad Kramer, okay. President of the National Bison Association. I'm the herd manager up in Custer State Park in Custer, South Dakota, and then also have my own operation, Kramer Buffalo.
How did we manage to pick the one guy out of that group over there that had a title of president and the herd manager,
yeah.
Which I know is no small feat?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so tell me what one does as a herd manager at the state park.
So I've been there a little over 21 years, but a lot of it is, I mean, we're a minimally managed herd there. You know, we actually have the longest running annual production auction of bison in the world.
Wow.
And so we have our annual roundup, which has become, in the last 10 years, quite a spectator event. We've had nine in the last 10 years, we've had over 20,000 spectators come and watch on Roundup Day.
Wow.
And then we also have our Arts and Crafts Festival that takes place that weekend also, which will have several thousand visitors come through that. And this past year, we actually had just over 150 vendors, which is the most we've ever had at that event too.
Wow.
But for the state of South Dakota, it's getting to be one of the largest events for parks and game and fish.
Well, yeah. You kind of have we went up to Fort Robinson in Nebraska and
sure.
Got to do the Longhorn Roundup with them, and that was one of the most beautiful things ever. But it was about as cold as it is now,
yeah.
And they didn't get anywhere near that many people out there.
Yeah.
It's kind of just us.
Yeah, yeah. The Roundup events the last Friday of September every year.
It was balmy up
yep.
there then.
Yeah.
Wow. But that's it. Okay, now tell me why that's an important thing to have a roundup.
So, I mean, it basically boils down to population control, you know, and over the years being there and explaining that to visitors, you know, the habitat, the grasslands can only support so much. And the park is almost 71,000 acres, but of that, about 20,000 is grazable acres. So we manage all the wildlife in the park is managed as far as numbers. So we have hunting seasons for elk and deer and that we manage those, or we monitor those numbers of those populations each season. And then we'll set, what the control and the management's going to be. So like for the bison herd, in the 21 years I've been there, our normal numbers, we call this time of year after the surplus, is about 970 head typically, and then we'll have close to 1500 in the fall at Roundup, so about 400 to 500 calves a year.
Well, it's, you know, that again, I'm going to go back to the Longhorn thing, because it management is something that, with even if it's a Longhorn that's been running around for 500 years or the bison, that's not an animal that's used to being cooped up in a small area.
Correct.
And it's self-managed, for not only in terms of, you know, foraging and things like that, but in terms of the breeding. So you really,
right.
You have to make decisions for animals that you never had to make, because we put up fences
right.
in this country.
Right, exactly, and that's what it is. I mean, when fences started, you know, 100 plus years ago.
The beginning of the end, right?
Yeah, so now, I mean, they are limited, even whether it's 7 acres or 70,000, I mean, they're limited. So as a caretaker, we have the responsibility to manage that. So you know, we, like in the park, we monitor precipitation. We've been doing that for almost 30 years, and we'll use that data along with the current forage conditions for that season to make our best decision. But we're still, you know, I always tell people, as over the years as I've been there, you're taking your best educated guess, because you're setting a number for the next season.
Yes. Well,
so
all farmers and ranchers do that to some extent, but if you're going to have a roundup where you're going to cull a good number of your animals, and I'm assuming culling could mean to the packers, but it could also mean to people like this that want to raise animals, maybe?
Yep.
Okay, so culling is a really important part of it, because you're figuring out which ones of the herd are going to go on, and it's all based on what's going to happen in the year, which is a harder and harder thing to judge these days, isn't
it? Right, it is.
Yeah.
Like up there, we're in our third season of drought right now,
yeah.
And in the park, you know, we have a little more cushion than it would be on a private operation. So, but it's something we monitor every year. And I mean, it gets to that point, you know, after a year or two, you have to start making some decisions, you know.
Yeah.
So we're kind of at that point right now, trying to look at long-term predictions and forecasts to decide, you know, this next year, do we need to start trending the numbers down? When I started at the park there in 2001, we were in a drought period, which continued for another 3 or 4 years. And so prior to me arriving there, I mean, they were already on that decline as far as our breeding herd.
Okay, so now I'm a Californian. When you say drought, do you mean drought, or is it the same kind of drought we get in California, where we're going to have to make drastic cuts, or is it...
It varies. I mean, like I said, this was our third season. So that drought period, I came into that in about, it'd been happening for about 3 years, and it continued for another three or four. And that's where it's been interesting to see the precip data that we have since the early 80s. You kind of see some trends, make assumptions on that, on moving forward. But, you know, they're all different. So you just use the data and information that you have to make your best informed decision and stick with it. But I also have my own private operation adjacent to Custer Park there, and you know, I run a little heavier as far as carrying capacity of the animals, but it kind of caught me a little bit this year. So I mean, I'm reducing now by about 40% from what I have had the last several years. So,
okay, so for people that are not familiar with the Dakotas, and I used to be one of those, because I went, oh, the Dakotas, and there's all that space. You know, I mean, it's just like space for miles. But you get there, and there's a beauty to that grassland.
Oh, yeah.
That, I mean, aside from those gorgeous birds everywhere you have.
Yeah.
But there's a beauty to these rolling grasses where the wind just goes through and it ripples like the ocean.
Yeah.
It's a glorious thing.
Yeah.
Now, Custer State Park, you have trees and you have, most people think it's just Sturgis, but it, you know.
Yeah. No, we're from the southeast corner of the park, which is about 3,200 foot in elevation. We're what's considered the foothills. So we do have them rolling grasslands and hills. Little bit different than when you get, you know, even several miles to the east out on the prairie and the plains before the Badlands. But we have a large diversity within that 70,000 acres from the southeast corner there at, you know, around 3,200 feet.
Yes.
You get to the northwest corner up in the Sylvan Lake area, we're at, you know, 6,500 feet in elevation. And you change from the foothills to, you know, a ponderosa pine forest and granite peaks and mountains. So so a lot of diversity there.
Yeah, and one of the most amazing things I ever saw in my entire life was in Custer State Park. We saw cooperative hunting between a coyote and a badger.
Oh, yeah.
And that was amazing because sometimes now you'll see it on the news, but that's an awe-inspiring. Seeing a badger is an awe-inspiring thing anyway, because those are feisty little critters.
Yeah.
But to see them doing something in a way that, you know, they were working, literally working together, and you don't really think about that, but it's not just one thing. It's not just the coyotes run around or the bison run around. It's the whole unit. But I would think that something like drought really impacts all of that, because the prairie dogs need to function. The owls are dependent upon the prairie dogs, and the coyotes are dependent upon the prairie dogs, and the whole thing just is really impacted by water.
So definitely.
Definitely. It's a scary time, isn't it?
West?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it cycles. I mean, you know, like I said, I've seen it 20 years ago, and we're in that cycle again.
It's just, we are.
How's it going to be different?
Yes, we are, time? Very much so.
That's one thing, I guess, you know, I've actually been raising bison for just over 30 years now. Myself personally, and the operations I've worked for and spent in the last 21 years plus at Custer Park there, but you know, being involved, like with our national association here over the years, you know, it's most of the folks you'll visit with here that are members or new members or old. I mean, it's this animal here that brought us all together.
Yeah. Well, okay. And now this is sort of an exciting thing. I look at it and I say, in what universe does the yak get second billing in terms of the wildest animal at the National Western, right? But it kind of does, because these guys are pretty feisty, and they are striking, and they somehow seem wilder than the yaks, which is a really interesting thing. So how new is this, or is this just because I have not seen them up close and personal much in the last couple years? How new is it to have bison here?
Oh, gal, the early 80s was when they first started the Gold Trophy Show and Sale down here.
Really?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
So is it because the bison have not gotten much press until the last couple of years? We're learning a little bit more about the nutritional components of the meat, and it's getting more popular.
I'd say a little bit of both. It's, you know, just with the technology and information availability that happens nowadays, it definitely is easier to, more accessible to find out about it. But like I said, we've been here 30 plus years, 40 plus years. So it's we're a little bit limited over the years. We've been limited by space actually here in Denver at the stockyards, but with this new facility that they're working on.
Boy, oh boy.
It's it's been quite, it's a needed change, and it's provided us, I'd say, a lot more security than in the past. So room for expansion in that. So so we got about 100 head of bison here for the auction tomorrow. You know, and the gold trophy show and sale is kind of the, you could say, the gold standard. So somewhat the best of the best that people bring in, and we'll see tomorrow. These animals were all judged. So we'll have the judges' comments tomorrow morning, and then the auction will be about 10 o'clock, and we'll see what the buyers agree along with that judging. But it's been interesting in the last 30 years to see, you know, just changes within the business and within producers.
Yeah, now is this something, you said they've been judged. Who judges the bison? Is it somebody like you that knows them, or is it somebody that looks in the beef category and says, okay, this is what we're competing with, this is, we're looking for muscle mass? Or how does one find a bison judge?
So, I mean, usually our judges are experienced producers, you know, and basically, I mean, you're looking at livestock confirmation is what they're looking at. So, I mean, there is data that you can, that we collect, so these animals are all weighed when they come off.
But the judges, fitting, though, I noticed.
No,
that, right?
No, yeah, they're.
you're not gonna
wash and no. Blow dry the bison. That's for sure. So, but you know, it is basic confirmation. Animal confirmation is what them judges are looking at. And I know just over the years, listening to discussions, and usually we have judges will swap out every few years, you know, and there's been some interesting discussions I've heard about on particular traits and animals and such over the years. So and it kind of comes down, you know, we, over the years that I've been in it, we are seeing, I would say, a little bit of a surge of new producers coming in the last few years, on a smaller scale as far as production right now, but you know, they're eager to learn. That's why we've been having our conference here the last 2 days now, and we have speakers. Yesterday I moderated a couple of panels. One was on bison hauling, so we had some experienced producers up there, you know, just sharing their thoughts and comments about transporting bison, you know, everything from equipment to loading, unloading, you know, what they found works, what doesn't work, what to watch for when you're transporting an animal.
That would be an interesting conversation, because, boy, these guys are big and they're a little,
yeah.
If I don't want to go, I'm not going to go, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing idea to think of putting this into our agricultural production system as it exists now. There's a couple more challenges, right? Like the longhorn people, again, it's not going to go in the chute because it's this wide. So this is a much larger animal, and it's got a different conformation. It's got a big bump, and it's that those horns are tough. So how does one handle that from a marketing standpoint? Because it's impacted by your ability to get the animal to market, correct?
Yes, it can be, that's for sure. But it's what it boils down to basically is experience, learning how to work with them instead of trying to force them, because you can't force them. It just doesn't end up a pretty picture if you try to do that. Yeah. So you learn their peculiarities and how to handle them. It's like a long time saying, we've always said you can make a bison go anywhere it wants to.
Well, you know? I always heard that you can tell a horse what to do and ask a mule. Is that so?
Yeah,
it's the same.
Sure.
Thing?
Yeah.
Look at the bumper sticker for all of you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just you know, working, learning how to work with them, and that's why when I got started, and it's still a good advice today, is we always recommend for new producers to start with younger animals. Because they grow up, one thing, they adapt a lot quicker to new places, and also you kind of learn with them as they grow up. So it gives you an opportunity to kind of learn how to work with them and move them and what they like. You know, they are not domesticated. I like to say you can habituate them.
Yeah.
But they're not a domestic animal, so yeah. You know, you can't get in there and lead them out of there.
But they do have a huge potential, especially in a place where that's warming and resources are not quite so accessible as they used to be. This animal, you would think, having just done on its own for thousands of years, this animal could really contribute something to alternative meats that maybe are not, I mean, yeah. Am I thinking that correctly, that it doesn't require as much water and as much hay as a cow or some other animal?
They can be more selective. A general rule of thumb I always tell new folks is, you know, that starting with the recommendations for beef is a good starting place.
Okay.
Years ago, they used to say, well, yeah, they don't eat as much and such, but you can get yourself in trouble pretty quick.
Yeah.
Just assuming that.
Yeah.
So it really takes time to see that difference and that transition in them.
Well, there's definitely more mass to them, that's for sure. I mean, yeah. That's a huge animal.
And as far as the nutritional qualities of it, I mean, it's one of the leanest red meats that you will find.
That leads me into one thing. I know that Ted Turner was really big on opening up not only quarters for migration, but he really wanted to market this animal. And he's got Ted's Montana Grill and all
that.
How important has that been to get the public to be exposed to a meat that might be leaner, might be very healthy? People like that pick up the flag and start saying, hey, we need to look at this. Is that something that has impacted the bison?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, the example Ted's Montana Grill, I mean, they've done a great job of awareness of the benefits of bison, and more so that, the education on how to properly handle it and prepare it too.
Yeah, because you don't always cook it the same, do you?
No. If you cook it the same as most beef, you're going to have a wreck on it because it's so lean. You just don't have that marbling in the meat. So, you know, we always say slow and low.
So it's like a goat's the motto. That way too.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, when I have new customers, I always tell them or ask, you know, if they're hunters, you cook it, prepare it a lot like venison or elk. You know, it's that lean, and that's what you really need to watch for. And even this morning, visiting with the room there, I said, you know, I tell customers and do it myself, a meat thermometer.
Yeah.
Is one of the best tools you have available when you're making it. You just put that in there and then hopefully you don't overcook it because it's really easy to overcook.
Yeah, otherwise my dad always said about a well-done steak, he says the cow died in vain. Okay, so
yeah.
I'm gonna go back to the state park really quickly.
Okay.
I am so impressed by our certain governments that have understood the necessity to preserve certain things. You know, Texas has got the Trails Association, and we went to Fort Griffin and Fort Robinson in Nebraska and Custer State Park. I mean, this is a huge part of our culture and our history, but we, in many ways, we have to manage them so there's this merge between the old and the new and the educational and the, hey, that's just something I saw in the farmer, you know, on the rancher down the street, why is that an animal that's in a state park kind of thing? So do you ever have to really approach that from the state park's perspective when you say, look, that we need to educate people as to why these things are important to the South Dakota?
I mean, definitely with the bison, you know, is our largest native grazer in North America. So preserving that, and then when you know the history about, you know, how we went through the late 1880s and that, and the decline of the numbers to less than 1,000 and where we've come back to, just looking at the genetic side of the bison population today, to know that there was, you know, down to so few numbers, and you visit with geneticists about it, and they're pretty amazed that we have the genetic diversity in bison today that we do because of such low numbers. And it shows the species how it can rebound from that, and when given a chance and you know, protected, how they can come back from almost extinction. So
Yeah, well, when you say diversity, are there clumps of different types of bison across the country, or is this something where it's a bison, and if we need more, you know, if my pool of 1,000 is looking a little narrow, I go down to where does one go to get bison?
So in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of work on genetics on them. And the technology, the advancement of the technology in those 20 years has been tremendous. So seems like every few years we have another technological advance that comes. I don't know a lot about it. I mean, I understand it basically. But the way I guess I kind of think about it and tell people is the technology has advanced to where it's a finer tooth comb all the time that we're finding out about the genetics to it. You know, when I first started about 20 years ago, it was on blood typing, and then we went to DNA genetic material, and now we're down to SNPs, and the number of SNPs continues to grow, and so we keep learning more and more about them.
Yeah. So now I'm also going to ask you, we went to Fort Collins to the germplasm facility, and it's an amazing thing where they store all the germplasm for all the agricultural production animals.
Okay.
You don't have horses in there, at least they didn't when we went. But is this an animal that you think if we ever needed to preserve the genetics, you know, say that, say something crazy happens and we have to restart somewhere, and we only get to pick the things that are in the tanks with us. Is this one of the animals that you would put in the tank, and if so, why?
I mean,
assuming it would be lost forever if you did not.
Right. No, definitely. I mean, because it is one of the keystone species of the North American grasslands.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of value to having them.
Yeah. They're beautiful. Yep. Beautiful. Well, okay, now before I let you go, I just managed to grab you from that bunch of people there, and I appreciate you talking to us. If one wants to learn more about this, do you have a website that you would like to push?
Yeah, so our national, the MBA has bisoncentral.com.
Okay.
And you can find, we have a consumer section, members section. We have different levels of membership. We have our supporter membership. If you're just interested in all things bison, you get our publication, The Bison World, that comes out 4 times a year with that.
Okay.
And access to some parts of the website. So, yeah, bisoncentral.com would be a really good starting place.
Okay, and I'm assuming maybe like many breed organizations, you have a little bit of a mentoring thing going on if people start with a new animal?
Yep, we do. We have a board of directors, and over the course of the year, I mean, this is our annual gathering down here, our winter conference all the time, but we have summer conferences. This past summer, we actually did more regional conferences versus one large summer conference. You know, different, just things transition and people are busy, and getting away for, you know, 4 or 5 days to attend them gets to be more of a challenge all the time. So this past year, we actually went to doing more regional gatherings, a 2-day event where, you know, in a region, they usually, one of our state and regional associations hosted it. And working with the national, you know, we put together speakers and presentations there, and usually a farm tour, ranch tour on one operation or a few in the local area.
Yeah.
And just a gathering of producers or people that are interested to just talk about all things bison.
Fantastic. And I'm just going to ask you to tell people about the Custer State Park. It just, where do we go? I think it's the National Park Service, or it's the state park of South Dakota.
Actually,
it's not a national.
State of South Dakota owned herd. And it was started in 1914. So we have a long history. And like I mentioned earlier, we have Custer State Park has the longest running annual production sale of bison in the world.
Yeah, and it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. Which 20 years ago, I never knew I would have said about South Dakota.
Yeah.
But it really is. It's beautiful. Beautiful state in general.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet.
I better have you. You're not shivering at all. I can tell you're from South Dakota, and I'm Californian, so that fur is looking really warm to me, but I'm not going to go over there to huddle up. There's no way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please ask your friends to join us. Please also feel free to post any comments or questions to our social media sites. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Backyard Green Films. Thanks again for listening.
We'd like to thank Chad for joining us today. And if you'd like to find out more information, please visit bisoncentral.com. Or if you'd like to check out Chad's operation, please visit kramerbuffalo.com. We'll see you next time with another adventure. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alera Bowman. Please tune in for upcoming episodes from our travels. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2023.